beat the Mets. Step right up.
As we near the end of the baseball season, New York Mets fans, if there are any still remaining after the team's recent losing streak and the injuries to key players like David Wright and Matt Harvey, their young pitching ace, they might agree with the team's first manager, Casey Stengel, when he said, "The only thing worse than a Mets game is a Mets doubleheader." That memorable bit of Stengelese was quoted by Ira Bercow in one of his New York Times columns about the Mets, which have now been collected into a volume called Summers at Shea, Tom Seaver Loses His Overcoat and Other Mets Stories. It's published by Triumph Books, and I'm very pleased it has brought the Pulitzer Prize-winning Ira Bercow back to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard.
When did you begin writing about the Mets?
I came to New York to write for Newspaper Enterprise Association, which was a feature syndicate, and that was 1967. And I retired, and I went to the New York Times, and I retired from the Times in 2007. So almost 40 years of covering the Mets, and then you know, doing pieces about the beginnings of the Mets with Casey. And I met Casey, and I spent some time with Casey. So,
but you were spared the worst days.
Well, 67 and 68, they were in last place. And then suddenly, and I'm from Chicago originally. And in 69,
so you lived through the Cubs.
And in 69, it looks like the Cubs were finally going to get into the World Series. And then the Mets came roaring past the Cubs.
Well, in the early days, they lost 120 games out of 160 their first year. Mm-hmm. And there was a cartoon strip in, I think it was the World Telegram and Sun, called Priscilla's Pop, and I always ever remembered it. He comes home from work, and she's crying. His wife is crying, and he says, "What's the matter?" She said, "Oh, the people in the soap opera, they have such terrible lives." He said, "Well, why don't you watch something else?" He comes home the next day. She's crying. He said, "What's the matter?" She said, "The Mets lost again."
Well, in Chicago, there was a saying that a woman was with her nine. The public address announcer came on and said, "Will the woman who lost her nine children at the game please pick them up immediately? They are beating the Cubs 5-1.
So what was it like in the early days? The Mets first got some players from a draft.
Yeah.
Is that the way expansion teams are together?
They are. And none of the other good teams in 1962 wanted to give them an expansion team any good players. So they gave them players who either were walking with walkers or canes or crutches, and they were all old guys, and Gil Hodges and Duke Snyder, and
but people who also were connected to the Dodgers and the Giants, who had left, and I assume that most of the fans, like me, were former Dodger or Giant fans,
mm-hmm.
Embittered that their teams had defected to the West Coast.
Yeah, that's true. And so, I mean, there were some who just said, you know, "I'll never watch baseball again," who were Giants and Dodger fans. And there are others then who just gravitated to the Mets and, you know, these so-called lovable losers year after year.
Have you ever wondered why, when people celebrate the old days before they went to the West Coast, the Dodgers are the ones who are usually remembered? The Giants, despite the fact that they had so many great players, are less likely to be remembered as the boys of summer?
I wonder if the Dodgers weren't part of the overall Brooklyn community. The Giants were in Upper Manhattan. I mean, and so Manhattan also, there was the Bronx with the Yankees, but it seemed that the Dodgers typified Brooklyn in some ways, or almost everyone in Brooklyn identified with the Dodgers as our team. People in Manhattan, they had other diversions, and so they didn't take the Giants as our team necessarily.
Well, ironically, the Mets played their first years in the Polo Grounds, the Giants' ballpark. And another irony is that Casey Stengel had been the darling of Yankees fans for years. George Weiss, who became the Mets team president in General Motors, had been with the Yankees for a very long time as well.
Yeah.
The hated Yankees.
Yeah, right. Well, and then Yogi Berra went to the Mets early on and became their manager and led them to a National League pennant.
Was it easier for you as a reporter to gain access to the players at a time when they were hoping to get as good PR as possible?
Well, in those when I first started, the bulk of the players weren't making much more money than I was. That has changed considerably.
Don Zimmer once told me that the most money he ever made was playing in Japan, and that was something like $25,000 a year.
Yeah. And I was making almost that much money early on. In those days, you had access to the players that you don't have now. And I mean, if you said to a player, let's have breakfast tomorrow or let's have lunch tomorrow, they'd be more than happy to do it because they knew you'd be paying. You know, now they're not interested in your paying. Or they're not interested in going to lunch and breakfast, generally speaking.
Well, is it a struggle for or a challenge for a reporter to cover a team that is bad? Do you have to look for odd angles or human interest stories?
Well, you always have to look for odd angles and human interest stories. But, you know, I mean, sometimes there's a story that just hits you right in the face. I mean, Alex Rodriguez is a day-to-day story. But there are other ways. I remember when I started following, I was assigned to follow Pete Rose when he was going for Ty Cobb's record of most hits in a career. And so you also look for odd angles. And one of them was in the midst of – he's 2 weeks to go before he breaks the record. And I was in the Cincinnati on the field at Cincinnati Ballpark. And they had brought a rookie up. And there was tremendous media attention about Pete Rose. And this rookie comes from Columbus. And so I began to speak with him about what his impressions were of all that was going on. And it was interesting because this player made a name for himself. And so we developed a relationship. It was Paul O'Neill, who later was traded to the Yankees. So it was a... looking for a different angle, and Paul O'Neill, for me, this rookie with his eyes wide open at all the attention that Pete Rose was getting, was a good story for me.
It's interesting that Pete Rose and a Mets second baseman, Ron Hunt, broke in the same year, and Mets fans were very upset that Pete Rose won Rookie of the Year rather than Ron Hunt. Of course, the history of baseball has proven that the sports writers were correct.
Right. And, well, Ron Hunt didn't have enough at bats to swing at pitches because he kept getting hit by pitches.
Now, you have...
He holds a record of, or he did, anyway.
This isn't just about the Mets. You talk about other players. And one column is Pete Rose deserves to be in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, absolutely. And the reason that I say that is that... he finally admitted to betting on baseball as a manager. In the Dowd Report, which was an investigation into Pete Rose's activities in gambling, there was not a scintilla of evidence that he bet on baseball as a player or as a player manager, and so only as a manager. So if Pete Rose had become a plumber instead of a manager after his playing days, he'd be in the Hall of Fame. And so he was going to go into the Hall of Fame simply as a player. And so he deserves it as a player because he was Charlie Hustle from beginning to end, and there have been no evidence at all that he created the gambling sin as a player.
Of course, Ron Hunt was Ron Hustle. He actually, you say, practiced getting hit by pitches. Yeah. But my argument for putting Pete Rose in the Hall of Fame is Ty Cobb is in the Hall of Fame, Cap Anson, a whole bunch of other really despicable characters. They're in there because they were great baseball players, not because they were great men.
Right. And, of course, Cap Anson was the one who said there was one black player named Walker in the 1880s, and he said, get that nigger off the field. And he was a very important person in the world of baseball in those days. And from that point forward, until Jackie Robinson, there were no players of color in the major leagues. And Ty Cobb and... Tris Speaker are on record of having colluded to fix a game near the end of a season, And so, baseball turned a blind eye to that. Kennesaw Mountain Landis turned a blind eye to that. And yeah, there were reprehensible people in the Hall of Fame. You know, gambling, because of the 1919 World Series, the Black Sox, that's the greatest no-no in baseball.
Until performance enhancement drugs came along.
Well, yeah, that's true. But still, gambling is even more important because, I mean, Andy Pettit did drugs. Braun is going to come back. So it's still gambling, which is this most significant.
Ira Burko was a sports columnist and feature writer for the New York Times for more than 25 years. He shared a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting in 2001, was a finalist for the Pulitzer for commentary in 1988. A collection of his articles under the title Summers at Shea, Tom Seaver Loses His Overcoat and Other Mets Stories is being published by Triumph. And we're going to go in and take a short break, but first, we'll listen to a bit of play-by-play from the 1969 World Series when the Mets won the World Series for the first time.
Gentry working hard here against Joe Torre. Now in the set position, here's the pitch. Ground ball hit the shortstop. Harrelson to Weiss. There's one. First base, double play. The Mets win. It's all over. Going up from this crowd. What a year. It's hard to believe.
We're back with Ira Burko, Pulitzer Prize winning author, now the proud author of Summers at Shea, Tom Seaver Loses His Overcoat and Other Mets Stories, which is published by Triumph. We played a little clip there, but actually I was kind of surprised when I heard Joe Torre's name mentioned. He didn't play for Baltimore. That was when the Mets won the pennant in 1969.
Right.
And ironically, Joe Torre goes on to become the manager of the Mets and then the manager of the Yankees and then the manager of the Dodgers.
Right. And now he's an executive with Major League Baseball. That was against the Cardinals, as I recall.
He also managed the Cardinals, didn't he?
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. He was a very slow-footed runner, and I think that he holds a record. Torre hit into four double plays in one game.
Well, he was,
but he was a good hitter, and he was a good catcher.
Great catcher.
And he had a good brain.
Now, the Mets won the World Series just a few years after they started. They were formed the same year that the Houston Astros were formed. The Astros have never won a World Series, have they?
No, they got into a World Series in 2005. Again, played the White Sox, and the White Sox, I think the White Sox swept them. The White Sox won.
But now they may be the worst team in baseball.
Yeah, but turning a profit because they don't pay the players anything close to what the other teams do. And so they're making a profit where some of the other teams who are paying the players more money and are doing better aren't making that kind of money. But, you know, what's interesting about that World Series with the Mets and the Orioles in 69 is that the Mets lost the first game with their ace, Seaver. And then they won the next four. And the last game that was Seaver won the game. And so at one point, Seaver liked to say, I was the only Mets player to lose a World Series game. And, of course, he was the great star.
Now, how had they turned around their fortunes so quickly, just 5 years?
Well, the pitching staff. I mean, somehow they matured. Kuzman and Gentry and McGraw in the bullpen. And, of course, Seaver. But Seaver and Kuzman were the great aces. And, you know, pitching triumphs overall in baseball.
Well, they also had Gil Hodges as the manager. He had replaced Casey Stengel.
Right.
You knew Casey.
Yeah.
Was he the character that he often was depicted in the news articles? I mean, those Stengelese statements like, can't anybody here play this game?
Yeah. The first time I saw Casey and was around him was late 67. He was now a consultant for the Mets. And I remember being on the field and being behind the batting cage. And he was talking about playing right field in typical Stengelese. And I was laughing as some of the others around them were laughing. And I suddenly realized, oh, my God, this is insightful. This is really smart. But he was saying it in a most entertaining fashion. But he was smart.
Well, I seem to remember that the first player the Mets drafted when they were being formed was a catcher. Maybe it was Hobie Landreth or somebody like that. And people asked him why he had picked that player. And he said, well, somebody's got to stop the ball after when the pitcher throws it to home plate.
Right, yeah. No, I mean, Casey. Now, Casey was a manager of the Boston Bees, which later became the Boston Braves. Warren Spahn in 1942 was a rookie for that team. And at one point, Casey told him to hit a batter. Warren Spahn refused to do it as a rookie. He sent Warren Spahn down to the minor leagues. In 1965, at the end of Warren Spahn's great, great career, he is with the Mets at the end of his career. And in between, he won 360-some games, more than any left-hander, but he was also a decorated a war hero, particularly in the Battle of the Bulge in the Second World War. And he said, Spahn did, that I played for Casey before and after he was a genius, because the Braves were a terrible team when he was a rookie. They were a terrible team with the Mets in 1965, but in between, he was his war hero, and Casey said that when I blow one, I really blow one bad.
Was Gil Hodges a great manager?
Gil Hodges was a great manager, and all the players, almost all the players responded to him. And he was fair, and he was tough. And you remember there was the moment when they're going for the pennant, and Cleon Jones apparently didn't run as hard as he should have in left field for a ball. And Gil Hodges came out of the dugout, walked across the field to remove Cleon Jones from left field. I don't know if that's ever been done before, but it just showed the strength that Hodges had in his own confidence. And Cleon Jones never dogged it in left field again.
Well, he had been humiliated.
Yeah.
How did Tom Seaver lose his overcoat, which is part of your subtitle here?
Yeah, it's one of the columns. And January of 1970, there was a baseball writers' dinner, and Seaver was given a Best Player of New York award. But later within a day or two, he was going to go to Rochester to get the Hickok Athlete of the Year award. Hickok Belts in Rochester gave an award, and so I went with him, and we took a train. And so we hurried with Joe Louis, who was also going to be honored in Rochester, and he was at the writer's dinner, and Kurt Bleffrey, who was an outfielder. I don't know what he was doing there. But anyway, the three of us hurried to get the train from the hotel and from the baseball writer's dinner. And somewhere along the line, as we were in the cab, Tom Seaver said, oh, my God, I lost my overcoat. I can't find my overcoat. And we never went back, but it was interesting that when we got to Rochester, we slept on the train. Seaver and I slept in the same compartment, and we flipped to see who would get the upper or lower bunks, and he got the lower bunk. And in a way, I guess I can tell people that I slept with Tom Seaver, but it was all very harmless. But anyway, we got to Rochester at about 5 o'clock in the morning, and we were waiting for a bus to pick us up, and it was dank, it was dark, it was cold, and he didn't have his overcoat. And Kurt Bleffrey, the outfielder for Baltimore at the time, had an overcoat, and he took it off, and he put it over Seaver's pitching shoulder. And he said, this should keep you warm.
Now, the Mets won the series in 69, and then they won another series in 1986, 17 years later. Did they go into instant decline after they won the
No,
first
they
series?
Won. They won the pennant in 1973 with one of the worst records that a pennant-winning team ever had. Yogi was the manager, and they lost the World Series to Oakland, as I recall. And then, you know, teams have their ups and downs. Players get older. Seaver was sent away to Cincinnati. But then they rebooted and came back and had a terrific team, you know, with some young, great players, Gooden and Strawberry particularly, and that wonderful first baseman, Keith Hernandez. You know, and then, of course, the memorable World Series against the Red Sox.
And you profile a number of those players, Keith Hernandez, Ron Darling, Gary Carter, Mookie Wilson. But when I think about the early days of the Met, I think that they had more colorful players, Ron Hunt, Rod Kneale, Choo-Choo Colbin. Were they more colorful because they weren't as talented as as Gary Carter and Ron Darling and Mookie Wilson?
I don't know. You know, it's all a matter of personalities, and I liked some of those guys with the '86 team, and one of my favorites who I feel should be in the Hall of Fame is Keith Hernandez. I thought that at first, no one played first base ever the way Keith Hernandez did, in which he changed the strategies of other teams the way he fielded. He was a clutch hitter, and he wound up a 17-year career with, I think, a .298 batting average. But his fielding was phenomenal. And, of course,
still tells us about how first baseman should play the position as a broadcaster.
And of course, nobody listens to him, it seems. Just like Walt Frazier told, who's he's the analyst for the Knicks. And Frazier told me none of the players ask him for advice, which I find astounding.
I once asked Kareem why nobody does the sky hook. He said, because it's just not flashy enough. But yeah. The Mets did have some troubled players. Lenny Dykstra's in prison right now.
Yeah.
Daryl Strawberry's had his problems. Dwight Gooden had his problems. He was here not long ago to talk about his new memoir or autobiography. Mm-hmm. And you have to wonder what kind of a career he might have had if he hadn't had to struggle with drugs. He would be in the Hall of Fame.
Yes, he would be. And, you know, after his rookie year, which was phenomenal, I remember Whitey Herzog saying to me that he has never seen a rookie pitcher with the ability of Doc Gooden, and he was 20 years old.
Now, you also have columns on Mark McGwire, Sammy Sosa, Barry Bonds, who've all been linked to the use of illegal performance-enhancing drugs. They've had incredible careers. Do you think that they might be considered for the Hall of Fame?
Well, they're on the ballot, and I vote for the Hall of Fame. I'm still I'm an honorary baseball writer of America, and I vote for the Hall of Fame. And I vote for whomever I felt was dominant in his time, and by statistics, but I vote for all those guys you mentioned, because as far as I'm concerned, I can't judge who did and who did not do drugs, and I don't know who did and who did not.
And as Bobby Bonds pointed out, drugs don't help you hit the curveball. But the book is called Summers at Shea. Have you been to Citi Field?
I have. I like Citi Field.
The food is better.
The food is better, and you can get a pretty good seat these days.
The Mets did pretty well attendance-wise during their bad years, but the fans have been too long-suffering in recent years.
I agree.
My great thanks to you for being on our show again, Ira Bricco. His book, Summers at Shea, Tom Seaver Loses His Overcoat and Other Mets Stories, is published by Triumph Books. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Leonard. My pleasure.